Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
All right, we got another one for you. Great guest this week. Very excited. Someone I've been wanting to have on the show for a while. I'll tell you about him in a second. I want to thank everybody who's been giving us reviews on iTunes. Need more. Please, if you haven't done it yet, go do it. Come on. Do your part. Be an American. Or tell your friends, family. Want to keep getting those good reviews. It helps all around. The numbers are growing on the podcast. So if you've been telling friends about it, thank you. And if you haven't, please, be an American. Do your part. Tell your friends. Send the link around. You know the kind of guests we get. Paul McCartney, Jay Leno, Bryan Cranston. Goes on and on. Adam McKay. And so thank you. And also, this coming weekend, March 23rd to the 26th, I'm going to be in Edmonton, Canada at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in a giant mall, biggest mall in the world, because I only play big malls, not small malls. So if you're in Edmonton area, come on out. And March 30th to April 1st, San Francisco Punchline. Definitely come out there. Great time. I've been there for going there for years. Great crowds, great club, historic club. So please come and check me out, one of those two venues. April 13th to the 15th, by the way, I'm going to be in Royal Oak, Michigan at the Comedy Castle. So got a little joke for you here, coming up for you in just a second before we get into the interview. My interview is with Tom Fontana, great Emmy Award-winning writer, created the groundbreaking show Oz on HBO, and people use that word groundbreaking a lot. It really is groundbreaking. It set the tone for shows like Game of Thrones, The Sopranos, so forth and so on. Really cool conversation with Tom. We get into a whole bunch of stuff about his writing process, how he got started writing as a kid. If you watch TV, if you read anything that involves words, this is the guy, probably the most brilliant writer and producer in television in the last 50 years, literally. So Tom Fontana coming up, little joke coming up. See you guys on the road, and please give us a review. Thanks, everybody.
So I was on a show recently, and they asked us, who manipulates more in a relationship, men or women? And I'm like, everybody manipulates equally. Women, I think, manipulate better than men because women can use sex to manipulate, and that's okay. Because great things have been achieved by men because women have used sex to manipulate. Like the caveman only invented fire because there was a woman whining, it's too cold to have sex. Boom, fire right there. Then they said to us, what's the most important thing in a relationship? Communication or sex? Now, because the cameras were on, everybody said, oh, communication, PC, communication. No, we know, sex. Because nobody fantasizes about communication. There's no guy out there going, you know what, I wish I could have a three-way dialogue with two women about how they feel.
I am here in New York City. Very special guest I've been wanting to have on the podcast for a long time. A dear friend, a longtime friend, a brilliant writer and producer, the great Tom Fontana, who's a little sleepy. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Paul. I am sleepy, and I apologize if my energy is low, but I will try to be as adorable as you are.
Well, let me tell people who don't know, and if you don't know, you've probably just been living under a rock. Emmy Award winning writer, director, created Homicide, Life on the Streets, the HBO series Oz, Copper, producer, creator, philanthropist, The Beat, The Jury, The Man Does Not Stop. St. Elsewhere is where you kind of got to start in TV writing, but we'll get to that. You and I hung out recently with Don Scardino, which is how we got to know each other, the great director.
Yes, that's right.
And saw him play here in the city, which was really, I was telling you on the phone, like, I didn't know that he could even do that. I mean, I knew he played guitar, but I didn't know.
Well, as I think I said to you, I've known Donnie so long, I knew him when he was a musical comedy star.
Right. And he was in the original production of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Of Godspell.
Of Godspell. Godspell. Sorry. Right.
And he did several other Broadway musicals, most of whom were flops, most of which right. were flops. And the great story about Don, though he should tell this story himself, he was a regular on one of the soap operas that shot in New York. I can't remember the name. And he got nominated that year for the Emmy, but in the category of Best Juvenile. Now, at the time, he was probably 40 years old. And he said that he took it as a sign from God that it was the moment for him to quit acting and go to something respectable like directing.
Directing. Yeah. And he's brilliant at it. And that's how we came to know each other, because He and I have been trying to develop a scripted half hour based on my crazy life story, Wall Street guy turned comedian, which a lot of the listeners know about. And we actually played around with it with you, and I was super excited, but we couldn't get it to go. But someday, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. You never know what happens. But
well, at this point, you should do comedian who goes, switches and goes to work on Wall Street.
Goes back the other way.
Yeah, you get more traction with the way the fucking world is today.
Oh my God, we could do 2 hours just on politics. And then Louis Black.
Yes.
Do you go back to Williamstown with him?
I go back prior to that because Louis was friends with a lot of friends of mine.
And by the way, anybody that calls him Louis is a very close friend. Very few people call him Louis. That's amazing.
I forgot. Yeah. He and his friends took over or were starting something in Jamestown, New York, which is known for one thing. It was the birthplace of Lucille Ball.
The
city fathers of Jamestown decided they were going to finally make some money off of dear Lucy, and they bought her house and converted it, and then they had this thing called the Lucy Fest, and they asked me to write a short play, to be part of this Lucy Fest.
This is the '70s, right?
This is the seventies. Yes, yeah. I'm terrible with dates.
Yeah,
though.
Don't worry.
It could have been last Thursday. So I wrote this play, and Louis was one of the was playing in the bar in the Holiday Inn, mm-hmm. As part of Lucy Fest, and I took my entire family, and they
You're
all
from Buffalo.
I'm from Buffalo, the great city of Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And I took my entire Italian Polish family, and they loved him so much. Even my mother, who you could not swear in front of, thought he was brilliant.
Was he? He was doing that.
Oh yeah, I don't know.
People say I swear too much, but
yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah, that's right.
That's like one of his great lines.
Yeah.
So he was doing that kind of ranting.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It was early ranting, too. So he hadn't quite perfected the ranting.
It was raw ranting. It was like, you know? Probably a lot of rambling. And
yeah.
But he's a playwright in his own right.
Yes. He went to Yale Drama School with Jim Yoshimura, who was one of the writers, producers on Homicide.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we actually wrote a part for Louis on the show.
And then was that every, because he's still doing that. Like he does workshops up there every summer. He goes up there for like 2 weeks in Williamstown.
Yeah.
Was that sort of that was the birth of that relationship for you there? Is that how you got to know him? And then it just continued?
I'm on the board at Williamstown now, but I wasn't responsible for him going up there, and nor did I encourage him.
It was from Jamestown where you kind of that.
Well, that's how he and I really got to know each other, and all of our mutual friends.
Yeah,
people like Jim Yoshimura and Willie Reale, and you know.
Well, we'll talk about you writing plays and being a playwright, but you talked about.
You're going to talk about my Pulitzer Prize.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't win one, so. But we can talk about it.
I thought I missed it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, shit, I thought I had this covered. I'm like, how does my friend have a Pulitzer Prize and I don't know it? This
is Believe me, if I had a Pulitzer Prize, you'd fucking know it, pal. I'd be wearing it around my neck.
I was going to say, you would award it to the Don. And Paul Schaefer was there. That was really
Paul
cool.
Paul Schaefer was always
this
great.
This was a night of
And Jan Krakowski a lot of great people and
Tom was sitting in a booth like in a banquette like in Vegas in the 50s with power just sitting there lording over the room.
Yeah, well, Richard Frankel, who's the guy who runs 54 Below, is a good friend of mine. He and his wife Kate, who I actually met in Williamstown, so they always take very good care of me.
Pulitzer Prize winner, you should but you said something that was really interesting to me that I wanted to sort of bring up to you.
I said one thing
you
that
said,
was really
well,
interesting.
You have a lot, but you said You know, you watched a lot of TV as a kid, and particularly tough guy melodramas like The Defenders and Naked City, and you said, I was drawn to one-hour dramas from an early age, which when I think of it now sounds ridiculous, but I was like, Captain Kangaroo, fuck him. Let's see what E.G. Marshall's up to. And you started writing plays like when you were nine.
When I was a kid, yeah.
And you'd like in a reel, and then you had kids in the neighborhood do the play.
Read them into tape recorders. This, right. These things we used to have called tape
and
recorders.
Reel to reel. I reel remember reel. My mother recording all the coverage of JFK assassination on the reel to reel.
Wow.
She put it in front of the TV. It was this big, for people who don't know, it's basically a big square box about 2 feet by 2 feet by a foot high.
Weighs 9,000 pounds.
It's like you couldn't do this. You need four people to carry it around.
That's right.
And it had tapes, just little, like a cassette tape or whatever. And yeah, I remember that. So, and I remember being, I was just a baby, but I remember seeing that. But what was, I mean, obviously it's in your DNA, but you were really more attracted to it at that young age. What was it about those shows?
I think the honesty of them.
In what sense? Because you've talked about that being a really important part of TV and TV writing for you.
Because, you know, the half-hour comedies were, you know, silly.
Oh, boy, I burned the ham and my husband's boss is coming.
Yeah,
what do I do?
And a lot of sort of over-the-top stereotypes. I mean, even the geniuses like Jackie Gleason, the stuff was way, 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 way over
and
the top.
Just to sort of pin a date on is this the 60s?
This would have been I was born in 1951.
Okay,
so it was the end of the 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, so it was still that big broad comedy stuff.
Yeah,
going on.
Yeah, and it just somehow didn't appeal to me. Whereas something as compelling, I remember watching. I may have mentioned this to you. I was watching an episode of The Defenders, and Jack Klugman. This is before anyone thought of him as Felix.
He's a very good
or Oscar
dramatic actor.
He was an excellent dramatic actor, and he played an undertaker whose wife wouldn't let him touch her because he touched dead people. And I mean, it's one of those things that just as a kid, I'm like watching this, going, "Wow, that's." I mean, I'm trying to compute it, you know. First of all, I'm trying to figure out what a dead person is.
then
I'm trying to figure out what love is.
What love is.
And then
sex.
I'm trying to figure out why this pretty woman is sleeping with Jack Klugman. So
there's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of things to work out. Yes. So that's why I said I have to write drama.
But something triggered for you that.
Yeah.
And
the other show that I was devoted to was Twilight Zone for a completely different set of reasons, because it had that element of surprise that I really found, you know, if you think about the fact that I was watching the Twilight Zone episodes when they first came on, can you imagine how frightening the moment was when the woman... they take off the bandages on the woman's face and she's... Gorgeous. And then they cut up to the monsters.
Right.
I didn't sleep for like 3 nights. It was so incredible. But
you were writing. What did writing do for you, do you think, at that age? I mean, obviously, these thoughts are coming into your head.
Yeah, it was just, I don't know. It was just stuff was coming out. And it was all terrible. I mean, terrible.
Well, you're a Pulitzer Prize. But you had written at 11 it's called A Sordid Peyton Place, where people got pregnant without having sex.
Yes, yes, yes. Explain that was one of my great masterpieces.
This explains Oz and everything else.
No, what happened was that I decided that I would write a novel, though I didn't actually, the only probably novels I knew were Mark Twain novels.
Right.
But I decided I should write a novel, and I think, I don't think the TV show was on yet, but the book, Peyton Place, was people were talking about it.
And for those of you who don't know, it's basically the precursor or coexisted with this. It was a late night. It was an evening soap opera, basically set in a place, Peyton Place.
A small New England town.
And they basically it followed the lives of these people.
And there was a lot of sex and skullduggery.
Right.
Yeah. So I thought, well, I can do that, but I wrote it about the people on my block.
And use their names?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know. And I wrote it in one of those spiral notebooks you have in school.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And anyway, I started passing it around, and it was literally a bestseller, though I didn't charge for it, and it was only the one copy.
So you literally like wrote it in pen
in
a notebook like this one that I have.
Yeah, like that. Yeah.
And then like you take the class, and then and all your friends started to read it. And
my friends, like the adults.
So, and you're naming these adults, and you're having these adults sleeping with people.
And I thought they were just saying how great it was, and I was like, look at me. And then I realized that they were actually laughing at the stupidity of what I had written, the sort of naive view of, you know,
yeah.
But.
And how did you knew that you had to have sex to get pregnant, or did you not know that at that time?
I did not know that at the time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is amazing because, well, I shouldn't say it that way. I should say that I knew it, but I had counted the months. So
wait, in terms of how long you have to be pregnant for the baby to come?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just was, I've never been good at math.
I mean, science was never my forte, but math definitely wasn't. So, but my mother, you know, my mother ran an OBGYN clinic. So we had all those books around with all the naked vaginas and things.
Did you? This is worth doing just to hear Tom Fontana say naked vagina. I'm going to just play that on a loop and put it on when I go running. So give me an example, like in that book that you passed around, like, so did you have like a Mr. Smith who lived down the street sort of having an affair with somebody else?
Yeah, with somebody else, which they probably didn't even like each other, but
I wonder if you stumbled upon something that actually was happening just by.
Yeah, like, I don't think so, because it wasn't like suddenly the book was censored, which my mother and father definitely would have done.
You weren't allowed to.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So.
But. And I waited all year to get the Pulitzer for that one.
And nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
Well, I have
been slighted year upon year.
Now, were your parents had to be encouraging this? Because when you get a kid who's 11 who wants to write like this, I mean, you know.
They were always really, really wonderful with all of us about pursuing our dream. It was, you know, they were first generation Italian, Polish immigrants.
Is your dad Italian? Your
dad's Italian. Was Italian Polish, and my mother was all Dago,
all Dago all the time.
And
so we're going to call you a WOP. We're going to lose the Polish thing. You're really.
I'm very
WOP.
Proud of my Polish heritage.
No, not that you shouldn't
actually.
Be, but you know, we like to kind of keep it.
Yeah. Okay.
Have you been to Poland?
I have. I actually went to the town where my Polish grandmother was born.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never been. It's people say it's definitely worth going.
For me it was a little bit like that moment in Roots, you know, Kunta Kinte, I am here. Yeah. I got very emotional.
Oh, you did.
The same way when I went to Sicily to the towns that my Italian grandparents were.
Yeah.
You get very emotional because you're standing in places they stood in.
Yeah.
You know.
And there's this connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
So, but your parents were always sort of like whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
To do.
Yeah. For all of us, they were like, look, we've killed ourselves working so that you guys can find your happiness. And
I wanted to be a carpenter. My father put floors in for a living. He's like, you're not going to be a carpenter.
Wow.
You're not going to make your money with your hands because you're going to, it's a bitch of a, like, you know, use your head.
Yeah.
So, of course, I went to law school, went on Wall Street, and then quit to be a comedian. I'm sure he was really happy about that.
Well, you used your head two out of the three times. Just because you fumbled it in the third quarter.
I fumbled it at the fucking goal line. Now I feel shitty about myself. So, with your writing and your writing plays, you know, you said something about... There's a lot said about you in the 80s that your writing kind of changed television drama writing because you had serialized story arcs and more complicated characters, and it was a less straightforward kind of writing. And I know you cut your teeth at St. Elsewhere and then built from there. It sounds like to me that that boy at 11 stayed with you, and you were bringing this brain to a medium.
Yeah,
that
unfortunately, my writing didn't get any better.
No,
I was still writing like I was 11.
No,
I mean that. Listen, I would love to take responsibility for all of the quality television that.
And you will,
but no, I can't. I was very lucky when I was a starving playwright, and Bruce Paltrow found me under a rock. And said, come out to L.A. and write an episode of this medical show. Mm. And I happened to go to L.A. at the perfect moment, to the perfect company, MTM.
Mary Tyler Moore,
Grant Tinker, both of them now gone this year. Yeah.
And Denzel Washington was on.
Denzel, it was his first real role.
And Moss, was it that guy? Moss, he does a lot of character acting now. Tall guy, blonde hair. Richard Moss.
No. Ed Begley. Ed Begley. Oh, and David Morse.
David Morse.
And Howie Mandel.
Yeah, and he was a good... Straight.
He was very good, and I was always amazed that he sort of veered off into other things,
putting balloons on his gloves.
Well,
on
he started with the balloon. We saw him with the balloons,
and you were able to see through that.
Yeah, we were able to see. But and he, you know, he'd been a rug salesman in Toronto, so we also got good deals on rugs. So it made sense hiring him, and the fact he could act was a bonus, you know.
So Bruce. Now, why was MTM the perfect company? Freedom?
Because it was small enough for everybody to know everybody.
Yeah,
and it was also totally respected in the industry by everyone, all the networks and the other studios. And Grant's attitude was the writer is the most important person in this process. Yeah, it was stunning. I mean, imagine my surprise when it. In the next place I worked, where they were like, I'm sorry, you can't come on the set. And you're like, what?
Well, you know, it's funny because you talked about, I mean, you know, Oz was a huge, huge show in television, in the culture. It's all that people were talking about. It was the game of Game of Thrones is now in terms of the discourse, and it was, and just phenomenal. But again,
I got lucky. I happened to go to HBO to pitch this crazy prison series at exactly the moment they were going to start doing dramas. It was before Sopranos, before 6 Feet Under.
This is early 90s, right?
Yeah. And they were looking for something that was going to make the biggest fart noise they could muster.
And in comes fuck with the 11-year-old brain. I'm like,
exactly.
Maybe I can have people get pregnant without touching each other. Well, you know, it ties into, of late, you've had projects that are international-based finance. You have international partners in Copper, which is a great series, in Borgia. And, you know, you've said it was the closest I've come to doing Oz on HBO in terms of the amount of creative freedom that I was given by my French and German partners. Mm-hmm. I would say that I was stunned by how little they demanded of me. It wasn't like you need to cast 5 Frenchmen, et cetera, et cetera. And you've also said that you think it's the future of dangerous television or unusual television. Elaborate on that. I'm fascinated
by
that.
Well, the two major motivating factors in Hollywood are of money and fear.
Yeah. Wow, I guessed it.
Yeah. And, well, you don't have to spend more than an hour out there to know that that's the
thing. And for those of you, those are people not in the industry, what is it fear of in your opinion?
Fear of losing one's status. Hmm.
Which means you don't want to make a mistake, which means you don't take risks, which means everything gets watered down in the same.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And so as in the last, how many years now, 10, 15 years, as the corporations took over the studios and the networks, everybody, you know, they're all owned by mega corporations.
Right. They're now. Yeah. There's holding companies that they report to.
Yeah.
Right. Which means bottom line issues and shareholder value.
Very important.
And for the guy, and this is from my world to do an M&A, for the guy sitting up on the top of that pile, he could, frankly, give two shits if you're making widgets or TV shows or movies. He just wants to see the numbers be right.
That was certainly true when NBC was bought by GE.
Yeah.
I think it's shifted now because at least like places like Comcast are more oriented to the business. But there's that element of we cannot fail, and there's also an element of, oh my God, we succeeded, and now we're afraid of the success.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because we now have to repeat the success. Dorothy Parker, the brilliant writer from the 20s, went out to Hollywood to write screenplays for the money. And she said the dirtiest word in Hollywood is another. Let's make another.
Oh,
sequel. So you get Spider-Man 12 and exactly. Wolverine goes to Paris.
And literally the same scenes have to happen around the same time.
Yes.
Like the car has to slam into a wall of some kind.
Yeah, if you want to make it even bigger, it has to be a helicopter slamming into the wall.
It's it's funny. I saw the sequel to Speed I was watching. Is it Cruise or whatever? So they basically put Speed on water in a boat, a getaway boat.
Is that right?
And then I was watching it almost like for analysis, and I was tracking because I had just seen parts of Speed. I was on the road. I was up late, and they literally just said, "Okay, this part here where the bus veers off and goes right, just change it to a boat and have it veer left." It was like nobody even tried.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody even tried.
That's why the dirtiest word in Hollywood is another.
But don't you think that's also a function? I've always felt like that they underestimate the viewing public. Like my father was high school educated, but he could smell bullshit a mile away.
Oh, my father too. And my father was high school educated.
And people are very intellectually, they may not be high IQ, but everybody is very emotionally aware. And they see through that stuff.
Which goes back to the whole thing about honesty. That there's so much out there that you can't really fool the audience.
In terms of content that they're seeing.
Content or emotion. You can manipulate. But people are, I think, more aware of being manipulated than ever before. Maybe not in presidential elections, but certainly on television.
By the way, I bought a house in Canada if you want to come with me.
Really? I got my dual citizenship. I'm an Italian now.
Oh, shit.
Yes, come to the villa.
I'm coming with you. I'll be your house boy. Not in a sexual way, just I'll literally work around the house.
Oh, well, all right.
All right, but if you want to, why not? you're saying that...
So what I'm saying is that you're right. It isn't like an intellectual understanding. It's like a gut understanding of what is a real emotion and what is a horseshit.
Right.
And that isn't to say there isn't a lot of television that just plays to the absolute middle. You know, Barry Levinson, my business partner and I, we call it Prozac television, where, you know, it plays out exactly the way you, every single week, exactly the same way.
Right.
Whether it's Supergirl or
NCIS
or something.
Right.
It's comforting.
Yes.
Because you know at the end.
It's like mac and cheese at 10 o'clock.
Yeah. And you go to bed going, well, good prevails and I don't have to worry about it.
But you want to bring sort of a reality. And for you, reality is life is messy and it doesn't sort of always end up the way you want it to.
Yeah.
It's disturbing.
But there are no heroes and there are no villains. There are only human beings.
Who have faults
and virtues. And struggle on a daily basis to be happy, to love, to achieve.
And you want to show that complexity.
Yeah.
That was why I think you were attracted to my story of like the doubts and everything else, which is still something I desperately want to do because I really connect with people on that level. And if you could say that there was something that you wanted of all of your writing, plays, television, that you wanted people to, do you feel now, you hit certain themes, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but I'm talking on a more 30,000 foot level, is there a certain sort of message or point of view that you feel like all of you, that permeates or runs through all of your work?
I would say that it has to do with the very dangerous word of faith. And I don't mean necessarily faith in God or a belief in a religion. I truly believe that every single one of us has to believe in something, whether it's the country, whether it's the Mets, whether it's that the sun's going to come up tomorrow morning.
What about yourself?
What do I believe?
No, what about believing in oneself?
Believing in oneself, yeah, yeah.
Okay, and why do you think that faith is
I think it's important because I think that if you don't have faith in something, then when the bad stuff happens and the fear comes, you have no protection.
You have nothing to grab onto.
Yeah. And if you say, okay, this is the thing I know. This is the thing I know is true about life. Whatever you believe, this is the thing I believe.
Hmm.
It's there to comfort you when the abyss opens up and you fall through.
What is that thing that you look to? Because, you know, religion is a big part of what you do. And you said, for myself personally, I believe. And then there are times when I don't, because the nature of the universe tells me that I'm a fool to believe in something greater than myself. So it feels like some days you believe in a God, some days you don't, which is fine. What do you grab onto for that faith?
I have faith in, I was raised Catholic. I practice it sort of in a half-assed way. I really strive to be spiritual. And by that, I mean that the thing that I fall back to is I really believe in humanity. I believe in the human soul. The shared human
the
soul.
The goodness of people at the core.
Yeah, or even not even as hallmark as that. More about just that we share this life.
Mm.
And out of the sharing of that life, the commonness of all of our pains and laughter enlightens us to behave in a good way. And
for the benefit of each other.
And for the benefit of other
people.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little Pollyanna, but the point is that in my experience, I have met no evil people.
Right.
Now, I didn't have the...
Maybe misguided.
Misguided.
You think at their core, people are well... Everybody's well-intentioned.
I think all people think that they're behaving correctly.
I mean, could you say that about Donald Trump? I mean, I don't make a big political thing.
Yes,
here, like,
I would say I truly believe that he is acting out of the what he thinks is the best place.
See, I think he's acting out of complete narcissism. That it,
we can make that judgment, and I agree with you. Yeah. What I'm saying is he's not sitting there going, I'm acting out of narcissism. He's going, I am a brilliant man. I'm a brilliant businessman, and I see what needs to be done in this country, and obviously what I think and feel and say appeals to a large number of people in this country. I mean, I can see
that's the disconnect where I can't... I don't think he cares that much about the country. I think he cares about this as a vehicle to keep himself propped up as in the limelight and keep feeding that narcissism. I think that if he could find something else other than politics to get that equal, but you can't. I mean, President of the United States is
yeah,
the
it doesn't
you can
get yeah. Well, but Mayor of New York is a better job.
Yeah, exactly. You got to deal with snow plowing.
Yeah,
but that's really interesting to me because to be able to look at a guy like that or look at anybody and say cause it's
who I don't like or trust.
Yeah.
I mean, but I you know you see him and you see. The way his family deals with him, the children,
they're loyal to him.
I don't know. You know, who knows what goes on in people's houses?
No, he seems like he's got a good family relationship.
So,
with those kids.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, in order to be a writer, I never want to write heroes or villains. I always have to look for both the good and bad in every single person.
And believe that there's good in everybody.
Yeah.
And that's what you try to bring through. Like even in Oz,
the good and the bad, yeah.
Oz, which was very dark, but you did try to humanize these people.
Yeah.
And these were, some of these were beasts, bad people who did really bad things.
Yeah. But each of them had some vulnerability that the audience could appreciate and say, well, wait a minute, now, you know.
Where did this compassion come from? Because then add to that, that you work in a business that can be very cold and very rough and full of rejection.
But that's why I live 3,000 miles away from the epicenter of our...
I know, but still you're in it. How do you keep... Where does that compassion come from? Is that your upbringing, your parents? Is it? Was there? I don't know if you've thought about this or reflected on it, but I understand some people are born with it, but I do think that that's partly a nurture thing. What are your thoughts on where it comes
from? I would say a nurture thing. The key was being taught to have compassion and empathy, or is it sympathy? Sympathy.
Empathy.
Empathy.
Yeah. Wait a minute. You're a Pulitzer Prize winning writer. And
this is why I didn't win the Pulitzer Prize. You make one fucking mistake.
They're sitting around a big table like this. I heard him do an interview where he couldn't
distinguish. He couldn't figure it out. Boom.
We're going to.
No, I would say that. But I would also say it was reinforced with a healthy amount of you give someone trust, and if that trust is broken, then you know who that person is. You see what I'm saying? In the sense of I trust people,
but then when they break that trust,
then
there's no coming back.
And I get very Sicilian then.
Yeah, you're like the Godfather.
Yeah.
It's funny because I have a string of material that I talk about in my act, and it's really become the core of my act, is that I hate people, but I only hate them because they break my heart.
Yeah.
Like, I want to think the best in them, and then I have a series of episodes in my life, and my wife is trying to get me, and then I confront people because I think if I bring light to their bad behavior, like I'm a human speed bump for the rest of the world, they'll change their shitty attitude. And then when they run into Tom Fontana, they won't be a dick to Tom Fontana. And then it turns into a Larry David-ish kind of situation where I create a bigger, you know, I almost got arrested on Amtrak and this and that because I got in a fight with the guy because he wasn't treating people well. And but, so but, I don't know where I am with that.
I think the core of what I feel or try to do is to treat everyone with dignity.
The most scurrilous character in your work.
Yeah.
You try to find some sense of humanity or explain maybe there's a reason why this character is like this and look back in their life and not excuse it but give it context.
But at least fill the character out.
Right.
So that because there no one is a one-dimensional character. I mean not in real life.
And why has it become so, I guess it's just, like you said, mac and cheese at 10 o'clock at night, right? Is that digestible? Let's just make these characters on TV real, like black and white. And
there's some shows like that. There's a lot of very complex television being written now, which is impressive and awesome.
Are you surprised Oz really opened the door for all of that, I think.
Well, I think...
And if anybody has not seen it, go get it. You're an idiot. But it really is the godfather of that television where, you know, Sopranos and keep going. Just make a list, a long list.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And you know, the hallmark of my career has been that I've always been too stupid to listen to anyone's advice about creative things. One of my dearest friends read the first episode of Oz, and he said to me, "You can't make this; it will ruin your career." And I said,
"So dark and all of that."
Yeah, he just found it repulsive, and I said, "Well, good, because it should be. It's about men being locked in a building and being expected to behave when they've all committed an extreme act."
Right.
You can't
it's like when people are shocked that football players like slap their girlfriend around. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you've grown this specimen to be this.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. You love when they smack the guy on the field.
Right. So he said, don't do it.
He said, don't
and
do
what
it.
Did
he
you
said,
mean,
this will end your career.
And what did you mean? You've been too stupid to listen to people.
That I went like, oh, no, no, I'm going to do it.
But if you didn't, but that's a true artist.
Well, it's a true sort of, stupid artist.
No. No, but I mean, you were also in the right place at the right time.
Yes, yeah.
Going back to, there's a bizarre phenomenon that works in TV. You said, success breeds fear as much as failure does. And you said, the other thing that happened is that HBO, when they got to The Sopranos, they started to just try to find another Sopranos any way they could. Hmm. And that when Time Warner bought HBO, what happened with a lot of broadcast networks, the corporate nature of the day-to-day life of HBO changed. So you no longer sit in a room with two people and say, like Chris Albrecht, who was the CEO of HBO. So you'd right. sit with the guy who runs the thing and you'd say, and he says to you and your co-creator, let's make it, and you make it. Now it's many layers of corporate BS. By the way, The Daily Show probably, I don't even know if it would have taken off today because Doug Herzog, who ran Comedy Central at the time, Liz Winstead and Madeline Smithberg created the show, but he had a hand in creating it as well. And he didn't put a limit order on the show because he knew that it was this new kind of thing and there wasn't a big corporate hierarchy to deal with. I don't know that would have been given the opportunity now. Maybe on the web or whatever. But
yeah.
But those days, which goes back to this international thing that you're doing now, those days are gone in your eyes where you can sit in a room with the one guy and go,
Yeah.
Even somebody with your stature and credits.
Yeah. No, I mean, the people you're talking to have somebody else that they have to talk to.
And they need to cover their ass and not lose their job.
Yeah.
And they're afraid. Yeah. So anything that's risky, like your friend said Oz was, they're like, man, they do an odds count in their head.
But see, also, we entered when I started in television, there were three networks. Yeah. Fox didn't even exist.
Right.
There was no brand. You know, CBS called itself the Tiffany Network, but it didn't have anything better or worse than NBC or ABC right. did. So you take an idea to all three of them.
Right.
You didn't go, this is a CBS idea. You'd go to all three and you'd right. pitch it to all three.
Which now, for people listening, networks have branded themselves. Like, oh, we just do happy sitcoms. And another one's like, we just like to do criminal serial dramas, whatever.
Well, and what they try to do is a lot of these networks that haven't previously been doing scripted try to reinvent themselves by finding their Sopranos or their Mad Men or their, Walking Dead.
The Americans or House of Cards. Yeah.
And what happens is that they don't really know what the brand is until
this thing hits. Yeah. And then the hit defines the brand.
The hit defines the brand. Now, the thing that was true of HBO for a good amount of time, and I have a feeling might be coming back, is that the brand was like MTM, we trust the writer. Mm. We're going to let Tom make this show because he sees it. We're going to let David Chase make this show because he sees it. Mm. We're going to let Alan Ball make this show because he sees it. Mm. And you know, that's when I think the best television is made, when you have somebody with a vision and a passion and you let them make mistakes if they make mistakes.
How did the international connection happen for you? Was that something that was sort of, I don't mean this pejoratively, but dumb luck? Or was this like, did you sit down with Barry, your partner, and say,
no,
you know what, we're not getting, I don't have the freedom
that
I used to.
I don't have that much foresight. I honestly don't. I stumble from one lucky accident to another. What happened was Chris Albrecht, again, was now no longer at HBO. And yeah. He had his own company before he went to Starz. He and Anthimopoulos, who was also at HBO at one point, were having meetings in Europe, and Canal Plus said, we would like to do a show about the Borgia family. And Anne said, well, the one guy who knows more about the popes than anybody is Tom Fontana, so let me call him and see what he's up to. And they said, well, that's ironic because we really would like to have an American showrunner. We believe that having American showrunners is really the way of the future for Europe because they have so few of them, you know. So so I was brought into it, and all the financial pieces were being put together.
Yeah, but that's not fall stumbling into. Your reputation got you that. Your quality of your work got you that. Don't make me get across that table and slap you. I mean, you know, but everything was in place.
Not everything was in place, but it was coming into, you know what I mean? The wheels had started.
This is so, because you said something that I read that you said, you know, when you went over there, this is a terrible generalization you're saying, but I would say the Europeans that you were in contact with truly admire American television, American dramas. I think they perceive that they don't know how to do it as well as we know how to do it. So I'm sort of taking the fire from Mount Olympus here in America and carrying it over to Europe and saying, here's how you make fire. Mm-hmm. And they were very trusting and sort of... this was back in the 80s for you in America where you're running the ship and you're not really answering to anybody.
Mm-hmm. It was remarkable. It was really remarkable. And one of the commitments that I made to Canal Plus was that even though the writers were all English speaking and people that I'd worked with before for the most part, I said to them, every year give me one French writer and I will train them.
So you're giving something to the system.
Put them through the whole system and eventually they can be a showrunner. I want to be the only showrunner in France.
Well, but there are people that wouldn't be that generous and wouldn't want to.
Well, you know, I'm also old, so. So one of them, Audrey Fouché, who was the first French writer we had, has gone on to enormous success as a showrunner in France. She's like the first showrunner in France.
Wow.
And I'm very proud of
her.
That's
great.
Did
you change? Sometimes people ask me, like, do you change your act from one state to another or if you go to Cannes? I'm like, no. Did your writing change at all? I mean,
no.
Terms of its style, not, you know, obviously the subject matter.
Yeah. Different. No, I, to me, it was still about character first and theme and trying to, you know, when you're doing a show that's set in a period like 500 years ago, I do an enormous amount of research because I really love history. Mm. And, you know, the cliche is true. There's nothing that I can invent that's more interesting than the fact.
What is it about the Pope that's become so, and how do you like the young Pope?
I haven't watched it yet. Yeah. I haven't had the wherewithal.
Yeah, it's a little,
it's like after we finished St. Elsewhere, I couldn't watch a medical show.
Yeah.
Because you go like, oh, there's that gurney coming through the door. Sure, I know that gurney. Ooh, I hope they save that person.
I grew up and I would watch Johnny Carson and David Letterman, beg my parents, beg them, let me stay up and watch. Let me watch the comedians. And now because I've worked in them and now I work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, I rarely watch late night talk shows. Yeah. And I love them.
But well, I unfortunately can't stay up anymore that late. Well, because I get up at 5. As you know, to write every morning.
He's got a very interesting process, which we'll come back to the Pope in a second, but you get up at 5, sort of you're still in a semi-dream state.
Mm-hmm.
You actually will review your work.
The night before, I'll look at, very, very casually, look at the first scene that I have to write in the morning.
Like you might have it outlined or bullet pointed.
Yeah, it isn't even, it's probably just like, oh, you know, Fred meets a giraffe.
Okay.
That's probably all there is there, you know, because you don't want to give yourself too much information or then you don't go to sleep because then your brain's already starting to write it. And you're going like, no, shut up. Yeah. Go to sleep. So, and then the last dream I have in the morning is that scene. And I have to get up very quickly and go to the desk to write it down because I also have absolutely no memory whatsoever. So
wait, do you dream consistently every night?
I mean, it's not every single night that this happens.
I was going to say, but if you do it enough.
But I remember a lot of my dreams, even if they're not related to
Do you take any sleep medications or anything like that?
Only if I'm traveling. Only if I'm going time zones.
I take
zones.
Ambien every once in a while, because my problem is I can't turn it off.
Yeah.
Then I go to sleep. Then I wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and then it all starts up again, whether it's work, creative work, or worrying about work, or remembering having... I've started to write stuff down, like to do, to get stuff out of my brain, but I understand what you were saying.
Well, there's a little trick that I do, it's not my invention, which is when I'm having trouble sleeping, I pick something like a TV show or a movie, and I put myself in it.
What do you mean, put yourself in it?
In other words,
one of the characters?
As one of the characters. And I sort of tell myself a story with myself in, you know, House of Cards.
So if it were The Godfather, mm-hmm. and you make yourself, I don't know, Sonny with his kid.
Or I'd create just another character.
Okay.
But you go through the story as you know it.
So like if I'm watching the wedding scene... And they're all sitting around the table. You make yourself another character at the table.
At the table.
And the dialogue's happening.
Yeah, and you're talking and you're like going like... Yeah.
And you're putting dialogue in your head that you would say.
Yeah, or stealing somebody else's dialogue.
And why does that help you sleep?
I don't know. It's because what happens is that I start to lull myself into... I literally will like... suddenly wake up and go, oh man, I'm still awake. And then I'll look at the clock and 2 hours will have gone by.
And so if you do this enough, based on statistics, I guess, or whatever, it's going to be a bunch of times where something's going to trigger and a dream's going to happen. And how clearly do you see, how clearly are these dreams? Are they...
The morning dreams?
Yeah, like are they, is it like, are you literally hearing, seeing words on a paper or hearing dialogue?
No, it's pretty much the movement of the piece.
Right.
You know?
In other words, not just that scene, but other scenes.
No, it's usually that scene,
but beginning and the end.
Yeah, sense of
how it starts,
of where
it goes.
Yeah, where it's
and
going.
And the characters. Do characters come to you in the dreams? Like new characters?
No, because usually I've planned what the next scene's going to be, so the ones that I've already created are in my head. If you
really
know
have to have your brain donated to something, not now you're using it, but when you're done using
barely using it.
But did you stumble upon this? Like, how did this? I mean, it's not like you can go and read and say. Okay.
No, it took a long time, obviously.
But you started when you were younger, like this would happen, and then you'd have a thing you write.
Yeah, I mean, the getting up at 5 to write was from when I was, you know, really young, because I had to work before school, so I had to get up, you know, and I wanted to write, so I had to get up and write, and then get dressed, and then go to work, and then go to school. So I was sort of in the zone a long, long time. This phenomena of the last dream is something that's probably only about 20 years.
And what is it about? I know it was because you had to go to work, but you still do it because it's not quite light yet? Is that?
I do it, yeah.
Because I'm thinking, because, like, if you go to, I mean, you normally go to bed at 9 or something like that?
I actually go to bed around 10, 10:30.
Okay. So let's say you went to bed at midnight and pushed the 5 to 7 in the morning.
I would wake up at 5 anyway.
Because you've just been
doing it. Because I've been doing it for so long.
Got it.
But here's the thing.
But it could work for somebody who gets up at 7 or 8. It doesn't matter what time you get up.
No. You could pick 3 o'clock in the afternoon and start writing then. As long as your muscles are saying now is the time I write, then. But the reason that I like 5 o'clock is that it's the only time that New York takes the breath that it takes, because all the party people are gone home from the clubs, and the garbage trucks haven't started rolling yet.
Right.
So there's this little like incredible silence in the city that I just dive into it.
I mean, we've talked about this just in just a little bit, but to get into the weeds on this with you, it's really, really interesting. I mean, and as a writer myself, I'm always looking for other ways to get creative. I mean, for me, it just has to sit in my brain, and I'll be walking around. I'm walking up the stairs, and then That's what I should say.
Yeah, yeah, no, that I do that too. To me, the second best place to write is in the shower. The problem is everything gets wet, but but you know what I mean, where you get the big idea in the middle of a shower,
yeah.
And then you have to like, oh God, I got to get this
and
down
the best
on paper.
Ideas come when you're not trying. So yeah, so I mean, this idea of being able to dream your way into pieces is really, really interesting to me. And you're regimented, which has always been really important.
Well, you know, discipline is. I think people who work in the arts or need to have discipline, so that within the discipline they can be free.
Because some people think, oh, you know, you let yourself kind of be free and yeah, maybe no. even do some drugs a little bit or drink yeah, a little bit and yeah. in this other part of you comes out.
I have tried every variation on the theme.
But you think the regimentation creates a space. Maybe some days nothing will come, but statistically
right.
speaking, odds will be...
That something will come, because what happens is that your mind and your creative soul know that this is the moment that it begins.
Wow.
So I have friends who, writers who read the paper and then vacuum and then paint the house and then they start writing.
Yeah.
To me, I want to get it done, because the other side of it is when I finish writing every day, I have done the most important thing in relationship to my career that I will do. And no one can take it away from me.
Wow.
No one can take, I own the day.
And
because
it takes
I
a
have
load
done,
off your, so yeah, it's not so sitting there like, I got to go to the gym. And now it's 9 o'clock at night and it's been weighing on you. It's like, I got the most important thing out of it.
I got it done. And it's like, it becomes like your force field of like, you can't hurt me. I wrote today.
And how, once you start writing in the morning, would you say it was 3 hours?
It depends. It depends. If it's something new, then it could be 12 hours. If it's something I'm just reviewing and doing a rewrite on, it could be three. Yeah.
And you write in longhand.
I write longhand. Yeah.
Well, this is amazing. We got to do another one of these. There's more we should talk about, but I know we got to get going here.
Yeah.
So this has been great.
Yeah, and, it's a pleasure.
I'm really going to submit you for a Pulitzer. You have my word. You're my friend. That's the least I can do.
Are there podcast awards?
There's the potty, they call it.
The
no,
potty.
No,
yes. Yes.
Is there anything that's it's coming out that you're doing that you want to plug or talk
no,
about?
No, I'm just...
You're going
I'm
to
just,
the theater tonight.
Yeah, I'm going to the theater
okay,
tonight.
Tom Fontana can be seen at the theater in New York City.
Yes. I'm going to the Acting Company. They're premiering a new play about Malcolm X.
Oh, wow. Well, you're a great supporter of the arts. And I think that story
the
about...
The arts were great supporters of me.
Bringing European other writers into your world and training them is really great and really sweet. And
well,
says a
I mean
lot
that's what we try to do here with non-Europeans,
yeah.
with Americans.
Yeah,
but it seemed only right to say, well, if you have a real need here for what I do, then it behooves me to try to help you cultivate people who can do it. Not everybody can. That's the thing about being a showrunner. Because you have a creative responsibility, and then you also have financial responsibility.
And you have to manage people, too. There's three things. There's a showrunner that I know who's a great creative type. He's scared of his own shadow to confront people, even in a, not in a bad way, but, you know, sort of demand things of people. And you have to have that skill set, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And most writers, you know, we want to hide in the room and not be talk to human beings. But
all right, well, listen, thanks for being on. This has been fantastic.
Thanks.
All right, that was my good friend Tom Fontana. Very, very cool guy, as you can tell. And I just love his process of, like, waking up at 5 in the morning and getting inspiration from dreams and all without acid. You know, usually I need the acid. Hey, come see me this weekend, March 23rd to the 26th in Edmonton, Canada at the Comic Strip Comedy Club. And March 30th to April 1st at the San Francisco Punchline in San Francisco. And April 13th to the 15th, I'm in Royal Oak, Michigan, just outside of Detroit, a place called the Comedy Castle. And please keep giving us those reviews. You guys are awesome. Please tell your friends about the podcast. The numbers are growing, but I need you to get the word out for me. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.